Crime Over Wine Weekly. It's Monday, April 8th. I'm Heather Holly, and here are your crime headlines. We're entering the second week of Chad Daybell's murder trial in Idaho. Friday, court ended with 57 potential jurors making it through. Now the defense and prosecution must cut the pool down to 18, 12 jurors and 6 alternates. Daybell is charged with 3 counts of first-degree murder and faces the death penalty if convicted. Investigators say Daybell killed his first wife, Tammy Daybell, and his new wife, Lori Vallow's children, J.J. Vallow and Tylee Ryan, in 2019. A jury convicted Lori Vallow last year. She was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Gypsy Rose Blanchard continues making headlines. The 32-year-old got out of prison about 3 months ago after serving 7 years for her part in her mother's murder. Blanchard is recovering from plastic surgery on her nose to improve its appearance and help her breathe better. She told People that she's going through a personal transformation journey right now, and that includes a physical one too. Blanchard's life changes have also included a haircut and leaving her husband. Lifetime is producing a new docuseries on Blanchard, Gypsy Rose Life After Lockup, which airs this summer. 6 inmates in New York will be among the millions watching the eclipse today. They sued the state's corrections department over plans to keep prisoners on lockdown during the eclipse. The inmates argued this violated their constitutional rights because the celestial event holds religious significance in Christianity, Islam, Santeria, and atheism. The 6 inmates will view the eclipse from the prison yard with safety glasses provided by corrections. And this week on Crime Over Wine Weekly, the search for the missing Tennessee teen with autism continues. What Sebastian Rogers told his father before he disappeared. Plus, an English woman's body parts were found floating down a river in plastic bags last March. How investigators say her husband murdered her. But before we get into those stories and more, let's catch up with Liam and Michelle. I missed you guys last week.
I know.
We
how was your
you.
Little Easter?
It was pretty good. Kids hunted some eggs, had a meal with my family. It was nice. Their little eggs had stickers and jelly beans in them.
Oh wow! I'm jealous, not gonna lie. That I feel like every time I see an egg hunt, I feel like I just revert right back to an 8-year-old. And so I feel really strongly about that.
Well, you're welcome to join next year's egg hunt.
Thanks. I was waiting for that invite for this year.
I'm sorry. I didn't know that they meant so much to you. I would have invited you.
Well, you know, it is what it is. But glad to have you back. We are so glad to have you back. Michelle and I had a great time last week, but it felt like there was just something missing, you know?
Yeah. That annoyed me.
Well, you can, that's your words. So.
I like to think of it as Heather's infinite wisdom, you know.
We all balance each other out. We all bring something to the table.
I'm the unhinged mom wisdom, so there you go.
I'm the gay one. Anyways, wine.
Wine, okay.
Heather, this was your week to pick it out. So if you don't like it this week, then I have nothing more to tell you.
Okay, so this week I picked out a Syrah because I had never had that before, so I wanted something totally new, and I didn't know anything about it, so here's hoping that it's a good one. This one specifically is a glimpse into Michael and David's Cabinet of Curiosities. We invite you to unpack the mystery and complexities of our 2021 Sixth Sense Syrah. Deep ruby in hue, layered aromas of berry cobbler, plum, and cigar box fill the nose. Full-bodied flavors of ripe raspberry, black licorice, and tobacco lead to a long, captivating finish that will have you reaching for another sip.
It does have, like, a lot of really interesting flavors. Like, and it's a very, very flavorful wine, for sure. And it's dark in color and dark in flavor as well. I will say the cigar box and the tobacco are kind of all turning me off, and the black licorice as well. And I am getting a good bit of that on the nose and in the initial sip as well.
It definitely is very complex. Mm-hmm. There's a lot going on. I feel like every time you smell it and you sip it, like you're going to experience a different flavor, if that makes mm-hmm. sense, because there's so much.
Yeah. I will say, deep ruby in hue, late aromas, berry cobbler, which is interesting, plum for sure. I have to say, this might be, I don't know if it's just like because of the ones that Heather likes, but I'm not a huge fan, I'm not going to lie.
I haven't even said that I liked it.
Yeah, I was about to say, Heather, what are you thinking?
or the first sip was like very overwhelmingly like I just like kissed a man who finished smoking a cigar.
Yeah.
So did not love that. I'm thinking. But I'm thinking this might be one of those that, like, after it sits and has been open for a while, that might kind of, like, recede some and more of the fruitiness will come forward. That's what I'm hoping for.
Yeah, I could see that. I could see it, like, calming down a good bit. I literally just opened it right before we started recording. So, I don't know. It's definitely, it's mysterious, and it matches the vibe it has, it's going on in the bottle, for sure, on the label. And so I give them credit for that, because I feel like if I were to see this and think, oh, I wonder what that would taste like, this is what it would taste like. And so go them, I suppose. But yeah, I just feel like it has a lot of flavors that I'm usually not going for wines. Like, I hate black licorice, I hate tobacco in wines, I hate, you know, I hate that smell and that flavor. And so I feel like it was set up for failure for me, in my opinion.
I didn't even read the description. I just saw that it was a kind I'd never had, and I liked the bottle.
This is fair. Well,
I feel like this is like a late night, like, this is what I would have late night if I'm talking to a friend or just like sitting by myself. Mm. That almost sounds like very sad. but that's kind of what I like just a calm, like,
yeah,
late night. This is going to be like my one glass that I'm gonna have. Like, does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure. It definitely is it's a slow drink for sure. And I could I could see it pairing very, very well with like steak or like a real dark red meat. I could see that. I could see it working very, very well with that kind of meal. I'm still getting popcorn in the nose. But that's we can digest that later, I suppose. Because we had, I had another interesting case this week, and I feel like it's one of those cases that truly, like, could have just used a little bit more, like, help, and, like, you know, it was just, like, kind of, like, you know, wrong place, wrong time, wrong circumstances surrounding this, Henrik Cyriac's murder, and it just seemed like it was just one of those situations where if things were different, we probably would be talking about this in a bit of a different way today, assuming that we would be talking about him at all, which I'm not sure we would be if we're being completely honest.
That was the one thing that I just couldn't get out of my mind as I was like listening. Like, it really does like just highlight, like, I never thought about what about anyone else who went missing or had something terrible happen on or around September 11th? Like, I just never thought about that. I've never like come across a situation where I've had to until listening to this case, Liam, that you highlight. And it really is like, how different would this be if it had happened a year earlier or a year later? You know, would it still not be solved? Like, it just really bothers me that, I mean, and at no fault of to anyone, you know, at the end of the day, because nobody ever would have predicted that September 11th was going to happen.
Yeah, and I also think about, too, like, would it have even happened at all had September 11th not happened, right? Because I think for sure there's an element there that I think there was like a bit of a bias potentially that played out against Henrik that led to his murder. And I wonder if he wasn't a brown man who was walking around in this like camo uniform, not speaking a language that no one really understood, had what had happened that morning not happened, would people have targeted him if that's what's happened? Because again, we like, if you listen to the episode, you know that we don't even really know if that's what happened or that's not what happened. But it's one of those situations that makes me wonder if things had been different, would Henrik still be alive today, you know, if it wasn't the wrong place, wrong time?
I agree.
Yeah, I did feel a little foolish when I was like, yeah, I never thought, like, crime didn't stop because a terrorist attack happened. There were other things that happened, and that's terrible for all of those victims' families to think that because of the timing, their case maybe didn't get the resources it would have any other day, or that it deserved, period. And then Also, just thinking, my family is of Polish descent, so I'd like thinking of the language. Like, I only know like one phrase in it, but it doesn't sound aggressive. And if you're trying to stereotype, it also doesn't sound like something any of the Muslim languages that, like, any Arabic language either. Cut that part out. That's a silly thought.
Yeah, I got. No, I think you're onto something like, there. I think you're.
But
right.
I'm just saying, if you're stereotyping, like that's right. Not like that's bad stereotyping.
Well, sure. Well, that can be said of like any jurisdiction across the country as well. I feel like because agencies across the country sent people to New York City to help, and like, you know, that obviously deters, you know, detracts resources from home, right? And so like that's just the reality of the situation. And so, and like, while all these people, you know, we're getting, you know, while this horrible event was like wall-to-wall coverage on, you know, on the news across the country, around the world for days, you know, how many people did die? How many people did go missing during that time period? And there's like, even like, I did come across, and I haven't really looked into this much, but like, there was like this whole, I think like either a website or like a Facebook group or something called like the missing children of 9/11, who like, and it was like children who went missing around that time, who like whose names you never heard of, whose faces never ended up on the news because they were all so preoccupied with what was going on in Midtown Manhattan. And so it's such an interesting perspective too, right? Because I think, again, kind of what Michelle was saying, like, I think about that time period and I don't think about anything else except for 9/11, and like nothing else was really going on. And then I also think about it in you know, juxtaposition to Sneha Philip as well, right? Because we talked about that as well on this episode too. We covered that back, like way back in episode 7 or 8 or something like that on the podcast, where, you know, it was like there were weird circumstances surrounding that case, and the family could not get attention for Sneha until they started saying that they believed that she was a victim of 9/11 and they needed help finding her. But once they said, oh no, like, we don't think that she's a victim, like, nobody cared, basically. And so literally down to the point where the brother felt the need to eventually start saying that they believe that she was a victim, even though at the time they didn't really think that was true. Now they've either come to that realization or made them believe that at this point. But it's just an interesting juxtaposition against the two.
I'd be interested to see data on how many murders were reported in the days after across the country and how many of those were solved compared to that agency's typical solve.
Yeah, right? I bet it's out there somewhere. I bet we could find it.
Yeah.
But yeah, man, what a case. For sure. And again, some people need to, there's someone out there who knows something about that. And we just kind of need to, like, somebody's holding on to some sort of information.
Coming up, the second trial of a known drug offender in New Hampshire goes to a jury. We'll catch you up. Plus, when we can expect a verdict. And the mystery surrounding missing teenager with autism deepens. The boy's father now revealing one of the last conversations with his son before he went missing.
Crime Over Wine is sponsored by BetterHelp. As someone who's used therapy for years, I know that finding a therapist can sometimes be a stress on its own, juggling your full-time job, your family, your friends, your podcast, and trying to find the right therapist on top of that can almost feel impossible. That's where BetterHelp comes in. BetterHelp matches you with a therapist that works for you on your terms. It's online, it's remote, and by filling out a few questions, BetterHelp can match you to one of 33,000 licensed professional therapists in as little as a few days. And because finding a new therapist is a lot like finding a new bottle of wine, if you don't jive with your therapist, you can easily switch to a new one at no additional cost. You can get 10% off your first month of BetterHelp by going to BetterHelp.com/crimeoverwine. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/crimeoverwine for 10% off your first month. Join over 4 million people who decided to get help and get happy with BetterHelp.
All right, this is a story we've been following for weeks, but we are learning new information in the Sebastian Rogers case as the search for the missing teenager with autism continues. The 15-year-old's father shared in an interview with Nancy Grace that his son told him he didn't want to go home to his mother's house not long before he disappeared. Seth Rogers said Sebastian never communicated signs of abuse, but he told him he didn't want to go home to Hendersonville. Rogers said in the interview that Sebastian would not tell him why, just that he didn't want to go back to his mother's house. Sebastian was living with his mother and stepfather when he disappeared from his bedroom in the middle of the night in February in Hendersonville, Tennessee. In an update last week, investigators said that there was no indications of foul play in the boy's disappearance and that all three parents have cooperated in the search. So, like I said, you guys, this is one that we've talked about several times, and we'll continue to follow this as the search for Sebastian continues. But, you know, it's like last week we were talking about death threats that the search party was getting, and now we're hearing from Sebastian's father. I wonder if investigators already knew this information, and maybe his father just has kind of held on to it and didn't want to go public with it or what, but I feel like this kind of chain, like, this just puts a different light on everything. Like, did he leave willingly? You know, was he coerced somehow? Like, none of us really know, but I think it's important that if he was feeling this way, feeling enough that he shared it with his dad, I think there is possibly something to that.
Yeah. And I think there's been so much, you know, conversation surrounding the, like, surrounding his parents and, like, you know, rumors and social media people coming out of the woodwork saying, hey, like, let's look, and, you know, hurling horrific accusations against the family. But I feel like this was like the first time that there's been like something that was there to actually like point to that, as opposed to just like a lot of skepticism and a lot of, you know, bad feelings kind of thing. And this was like the first time that, you know, but I could also see there was like, if for whatever reason, maybe just Sebastian just didn't like being living with his mom for whatever reason. Like, I could also see that being evidence that maybe he did just wander off on his own and went somewhere and doesn't want to come home and doesn't want to live with them for that reason, but not necessarily have anything to do with, you know, that the mother and the stepfather did anything bad. So it could, I feel like I could interpret that both ways. But again, I think that's the first time that I've heard of something that actually like casts like a legitimate shadow of a doubt over the mother and the stepfather, who, again, I mean, we've been talking about for weeks, have been doing things that maybe, you know, at the very least we wouldn't have done if we were in their situations, but not necessarily flat out incriminating. You know, like they left their family home and like they up and moved, and there's just a lot of weird things surrounding that. But again, this was the first time that I feel like somebody has kind of almost pointed a finger at them in a legitimate way.
And like you were saying, it's not, maybe it wasn't even necessarily finger pointing, because taking in consideration that he is a young boy with autism, it could have been anything from an environmental thing, like there were too many sounds that he didn't like in that area, right, or yeah, something else that bothered him. It may not have even been something about his mother. It was just that house and that location.
Right, precisely. Yeah. And I think what I was trying to say was like, I think that was like the first time, like anything that has been said that could be legitimately interpreted, I suppose, is what I was trying to say, as being pointed as the mother and the stepfather. I'm not saying that's what his dad is doing necessarily. But I think that it could be legitimately interpreted as that, as opposed to just a lot of other things have been, you know, interpreted that way, because I think a lot of people online have wanted to interpret it that way. But very good point. Again, I think it very well could have been, this comment very well could have been, you know, surrounding Sebastian just not feeling comfortable at home for one reason or another, regardless of what the reason is necessarily. And to that point, exactly, like, I mean, it could just be as simple as, you know, like it not feeling right, or like it not feeling like home because of XYZ, or because of his, you know, neurodivergence. It could mean a lot of things, for sure. And I think in the press, I watched the press conference too last week that the police department held for Sebastian to give give an update on the Sebastian's case, which wasn't really much of an update. But they did specifically say that there was no evidence of foul play, but they also aren't ruling foul play out necessarily. They just have not. I think that that's just where they're at, is just like they don't have evidence. They don't have pretty much any evidence, interestingly enough.
Yeah, and that's something that still doesn't sit right with me in 2024, that there's no video evidence whatsoever of him, no glimpse or whatever. That's still really weird to me. Yeah, and then the threats.
Yeah, that's fair. And I think about like that video, and I keep thinking about it, and people have said that it's maybe not 100% legit, but like that video of the two flashlights leaving the home that night, it was literally just two specks of light. We talked about it a couple weeks ago. Feels significant. Even I don't know, I could be proven wrong, but that to me feels like a pretty big piece of evidence if that's around the time that we think that Sebastian went missing. I don't know, I could really kind of see it either way, in my opinion.
I'd be interested in knowing the last time that we know that he was seen was by the mom, when he, you know, went to bed that night. So prior to that, like, when was the last time he was, like, actually seen? I'm, like, interested in, like, some video evidence or something. You know, was it the day before? I'm just interested in, like, that timeline. But I don't know if that's anything that they would share at this point. You know what I mean? Especially if there is a chance that there could be foul play, you know, that would play directly into an investigation. So I get that. But I am interested in like, I just think about like that timeline.
Yeah. And I'd be curious to know, like, when this comment was made in relation to him going missing to his dad, like, when was he being dropped back off in Hendersonville? Like, when was the last time his dad saw him? And I'm sure maybe that's been shared and I just missed it, and I'm just don't know when that is, but I think that feels significant as well.
So this is obviously a case we're going to continue to follow, and we'll keep you guys updated. But if you have any information about Sebastian Rogers, call 1-800-TBI-FIND. And Heather, what do you have for us this week?
My case is actually across the pond, and starts in 2023. A person walking discovered plastic bags floating down a river in Bassingham, England, last March. Those bags contained the body parts of Holly Bramley. Police recovered 224 pieces of the 26-year-old's remains, but some of her body parts were never found. Holly married Nicholas Metzen in 2021. Police questioned him about Holly's death, and he initially denied killing her, but recently pleaded guilty to murder. During Friday's hearing, the prosecutor said evidence suggests Metzen killed Holly in their bedroom, dismembered her in the bathroom, and stored her remains in the kitchen pantry for a week before paying a friend to dispose of them. Authorities say Metzen never shared why or how specifically he killed his wife. Holly's family told the court that the couple's marriage was broken beyond repair and they were on the verge of separation when Holly was killed. Holly's mother says Metzen was controlling and she wasn't able to see her daughter in the years leading up to her death. Metzen has three previous convictions for crimes against former partners. He's scheduled to be sentenced today, Monday.
Wow. So, okay, so first of all, I have covered cases where bodies have been dismembered, and I've sat through trials with that, and I've listened to like testimony. It is not easy to dismember a body. It is not like, it's not like Dexter, where it's, you know, you can do it in one episode. It is not easy. And so to think about like going through that process at least 224 times, that is gross.
Yeah, and then the cleanup that went with all that, because they, like, that is part of the evidence too, is like when police came to question him, they could tell he had been like quote-unquote redecorating, and there was a very strong smell of ammonia, and they later determined a very large dark spot on the floor to be her blood. So yeah, he had a very busy and gruesome few days, and I don't know how, what kind of state of mind do you get into to do that to someone, especially that you were married to? Like, you supposedly loved her at some point.
And then to pay a friend to dispose of it, like, I'm a good friend, but Heather, if you call me up and you're like, hey, I need you to do me a favor, I'm going to be like, I don't know, girl.
Yeah, I'm not hiding any of your bodies. I'm just letting y'all know right now, just in case there are any questions about that.
Okay, but how good did the friend dispose of them when someone found the bags floating down a river? He just tossed her body parts in a river and thought that that was the end of it? I mean, maybe he did that note, like, maybe subconsciously he was like, yeah, like, dude's gonna get caught, but I don't know. It sounds like it's just a gruesome thriller flick or horror movie, but this was this poor 26, like, not even 30, like, hadn't reached the pinnacle of her life, and this would-be of a man has chopped her up into hundreds of pieces.
Yeah, I want to, I also want to say that, and this hopefully doesn't sound too accusatory, but someone who can do that and knows how to do that, frankly, probably has done it before, if I am going to venture a guess. And so I'd be curious to know if they have that thought in mind when looking into this dude, because it just feels very professional.
I know, because the reports I saw, he did have 3 previous convictions of things that he did to former partners. None of them were blatantly listed as murder or dismemberment, but he has at least assaulted or abused before and been caught on 3 separate occasions.
Man, I bet those women are like thanking their lucky stars for sure. Imagine, dear Lord, dear Lord.
I think it's like an example of, you know, what can really happen in domestic violence situations. And I'm definitely not trying to like victim blame or anything like that, but like, it doesn't get better. You know what I mean? And if you have any inkling that you need to get out, you need to get out, you know, and there is help out there. And I think that should, that's a really good reminder of the resources and things, you know, that can help someone out in a situation like that.
Yeah, and if you're a loved one, like her mom in court says that she didn't get to see her for the past several years and blames medicine's controlling behavior for that. So if you're a loved one noticing those changes in your loved one, say something. It's hard, and you don't want to start an argument or make things worse, but they may not know. They may be love blind and not know that that's not right.
Well, and I'll just put this in here as well. National Domestic Violence Hotline. If you or someone you know needs some help, call 1-800-799-7233.
And from one murder case to another, Liam, what's going on in your world?
Yeah, so I am bringing it back to a case that we actually covered in headlines a couple weeks ago. It's the double murder trial against Timothy Verrill, which is now in a jury's hands as of last week. Timothy Verrill is accused of beating and stabbing Christine Sullivan and Jenna Pellegrini before he put their bodies under the porch of a house that was owned by another associate of his. Timothy was known to be involved in drug activity with at least one of the victims. Prosecutors presented evidence that Timothy's DNA was consistent with DNA found on a blood-soaked baseball cap found at the crime scene, while defense attorneys proved DNA found under the victim's fingernails was not consistent with Timothy's DNA. This is Timothy's second trial for the crime. A judge declared a mistrial back in 2019 after evidence was presented pointing to issues with the discovery on the side of the state. The defense rested on Friday, and we are expecting a verdict this week. So I think just another example of how how mistakes and issues and, you know, possible malpractice has very real consequences and very real, you know, circumstances that could come out of a situation. And so that's why I've said it before, I'll say it again, we should be holding police officers, prosecutors, investigators, you know, anyone who has their hands in any way, shape, or form, you know, pathologists on a case. We need to be holding those people to a very high standard, because it could be very easy, if Timothy is really guilty in this whole situation, it could be very easy for him to get off in the second time around. And who really knows? I'm not really getting a good feel for how this trial is going, because it really, I think it could go really either way. I think the fact that his blood was found at the scene is notable, but also, or his DNA, I should say, is found at the scene is notable. But I also think, you know, from my understanding, I think that like the logical excuse here is this was clearly a home where drugs were being done, that, you know, and people were spending a lot of time at this house. And so who's to say that his DNA wasn't there just because he was known to be there?
Hopefully the investigators who did their due diligence and can prove that. Can say that.
Sure. Well, I think that's possible. And I think too, like, you know, the fact that, you know, I don't know what kind of evidence was supposed to be, you know, presented the first time around that didn't end up being presented. They never like talked about that because it never got to that point, in the first trial. And so I would be interested to know like how much of that evidence isn't allowed to be presented this time around, if anything at all, or if they fixed the discovery from the beginning, from the first time around. So it's just, there's a lot of things that could be done here for sure. Well, coming up in Karma for One Weekly, two moms vanish while picking up their children from school, why investigators believe the pair are in danger, plus new developments in a missing Army National Guard sergeant out of New York, what police found, and why it has his family worried sick.
Hello, Crime Over Wine listeners. I am Rachel.
And I'm Heather.
We are the hosts of Like Mother, Like Murder.
We bring you the good, the badass, and the crime.
Each week, we bring you stories from missing and murdered
to survivors and women who empower you.
And of course, some mom talk sprinkled in.
Check us out wherever you get your podcasts at Like Mother, Like Murder.
And give us a follow on social media so that we can say hi.
Okay, love you, bye.
Okay, love you, bye.
Hello, everybody. This is Liam Collins, the host of the podcast Crime Over Wine, and your Wine Wednesday just got so much better. Every week, we share a new true crime story over a new bottle of wine. So your new true crime adventure starts right now, every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Police in Fayetteville, North Carolina are looking for help in an unusual missing persons case. Involves two young people who haven't been heard from for years. Blake Devin has been missing since 2022. He was 15 years old then, but police are just now learning about it. London Devin was last seen in 2019. She was about 22 years old. The two are related, but authorities have not shared how. Right now, detectives are piecing together a timeline of events. WRAL spoke to Blake's aunt, who said that he was placed in foster care several years ago, and his adoptive mother never enrolled him in school and instead chose to homeschool him. Authorities only learned about London's disappearance once they started investigating Blake's case, and not much has been shared about her. The FBI has joined the investigation with Fayetteville Police. They're asking anyone who's had any contact with Blake or London in recent years to contact them. If you have any information, contact the FBI at 704-672-6100 or Fayetteville Police at 910-578-2697.
Police in Georgia are looking for a missing mother and the person who cleaned out the woman's apartment after she disappeared. 23-year-old Brianna Winston is believed to have last been at her apartment in Clayton County, Georgia on March 16th. Brianna has since not shown up to either of her two jobs. An employee at the leasing office at her apartment complex said they did see someone cleaning out the apartment after Brianna was believed to already have gone missing. Brianna's father, searched the property and found a bag with her shoes inside, which smelled of bleach. Brianna's 4-year-old daughter is with her father, who Brianna was known to have a rocky relationship with. If you know anything about Brianna's disappearance, call the Clayton County Sheriff's Office at 678-610-4713.
A search is underway for two Kansas moms out of Oklahoma, and investigators now say they suspect foul play. Veronica Butler, 27, and Jillian Kelly, 39, have not been seen since they left together to pick up their children in Oklahoma. The car they were seen driving was found abandoned near a highway in Oklahoma. Last week, investigators said that they found evidence to indicate foul play based on a recent search of the abandoned car. Investigators say the women are believed to be in danger since no one heard from them in the days and their vehicle was seen in a, quote, very rural area of the state. The women never made it to the location to pick up the children. Anyone with information should call the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation at 1-800-52.
A Georgia family is now offering a $5,000 reward in hopes it'll help bring their loved one home. Nicholas Crawford was reported missing in Richmond County, Georgia on August 13, 2023. The 44-year-old was last seen on Southgate Drive. Authorities say Crawford's cell phone was found near a park in the days after his disappearance, and there hasn't been any contact with him since. If you have any information, contact the Richmond County Sheriff's Office at 706-432-52.
12-year-old Lori Page has been missing for almost a year. She was last seen on June 3rd, 2023 in Tallahassee, Florida. Since then, the FBI and the Tallahassee Police Department have deployed dive teams at local lakes, but there has been no sign of Lori. She was last seen near San Luis Mission Park in Tallahassee, but has ties to or may visit Tampa, Florida, Thomasville, Georgia, and Nashville, Tennessee. If you know anything about Lori Page's disappearance, call the Tallahassee Police Department at 850-891-4200.
Authorities in California have issued an endangered missing advisory for two young boys believed to have been taken by their mother. The California Highway Patrol issued the statewide alert on Saturday for Daniel Wu, age 9, and David Wu, age 4. Authorities say the boy's mother, Taylor Wu, took her sons using a Ford Escape SUV. The boy's father is not reported missing, but it remains clear if the couple is divorced, estranged, or engaged in a custody dispute regarding the boys. If you have any information, call the Mountain View Police Department at 650-903-6344.
A 92-year-old veteran has been missing in East Moline, Illinois for more than a week. Bill Weber's family last saw him March 29th while delivering groceries to his apartment. When they returned the next morning, Weber, his walker, and car were all gone. Weber's family tells KWQC he's pretty much been homebound since getting hurt in October, but even before the injury, there were only a few places he would drive. KWQC reports Weber left his wallet behind and only had 1/3 of a tank of gas. Weber has a heart condition and requires medication, which he did not take with him. His family says missing it for this long could be detrimental. Bill Weber's 5'11", with gray hair and blue eyes. He may be wearing an Iowa Hawkeyes jacket, blue t-shirt, sweatpants, and slippers. His car is a silver Chevy Malibu with Illinois purple heart plates. If you have any information, contact police at 309-752-1555.
Police found the car belonging to Sergeant Nicholas Faust last week. We told you in our last episode about the missing Army National Guard sergeant who was last seen at a bar in Poughkeepsie, New York on March 23rd. State police found his car behind a home where he attended a party that night. His family says he lived out of that car and many of his personal belongings were still inside of it. If you know anything about his disappearance, call New York State Police at 845-677-7300.
A search is underway for a 10-month-old baby in Michigan. The baby, named True Jones, was turned over to her biological father, Jaden Cathy, in late January. That's according to the Southfield Police Department. True's mother has since obtained full parental rights since then, but has not been able to find the baby. Police also have not been able to find her father. Anyone with information about True or her father should call the Southfield Police Department at 248 796-5500.
And that's all we have this week. Thanks for listening, everybody. If you can't get enough of Crime Over Wine, follow all of us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We'll see you next Monday for the next episode of Crime Over Wine Weekly. And we'll see you this Wine Wednesday for your regularly scheduled episode of Crime Over Wine.
Proud member of the Podnuga Network.